Creeping Charlie, lamb's quarters, dandelion, wild garlic, crabgrass, ragweed. The list could go on and on. This afternoon, we're going to consider or reconsider the weed. Our guest is a weed scientist. Her name is Nancy Gift. She would like us to reconsider the weed. She says it is okay, even laudable, to love some of these plants. So, listeners, what do you think? Do you live with weeds? Are there some you can live with, some you like? Is there a weed that you loathe? Join us with your thoughts this afternoon. Questions about weeds also invited. Give us a call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Nancy Gift, is Assistant Professor of Environmental Studies and Acting Director of the Rachel Carson Institute at Chatham University in Pittsburgh. She is the author of A Weed by Any Other Name, The Virtues of a Messy Lawn, or Learning to Love the Plants We Don't Plant. Nancy Gift's book, A Weed by Any Other Name, is published by the Beacon Press. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And you'll find our guest online at this site, weedsandkids.blogspot.com, weedsandkids.blogspot.com. Nancy Gift, welcome. How are you?
Wonderful. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. You say that weeds can tell us about the land. What can they tell us?
Well, they can certainly tell us whether or not the soil is compacted. If your dog is running on a particular spot on your lawn at the same time every day or lots of times, then that spot will be compacted soil. And some weeds will grow better in that soil than you might like. And also the weeds can tell you if the soil is too acidic sometimes, if it's too basic. They can tell you about the drought levels of the soil, if it tends to be too dry or too wet. So there's actually quite a lot it can tell you.
Yeah. How did you come to this appreciation of weeds?
As a child, my grandmother was a big wildflower enthusiast, and I enjoyed listening to her stories about how plants got their common names. And as an undergraduate, I started studying plants as an academic, and then decided I wanted to do something useful with plants. But since I had a plant ID background, when I applied to grad school, they very quickly led me toward the weed scientists. And it turned out to be a much better fit than I would have known, especially since before I applied to that program, I didn't even know there was such a thing as a weed scientist.
Mm. Are there many weed scientists who feel as you do about weeds?
I think there are a lot of there are just a few weed scientists per state, basically, that there are weed scientists who work in ag extension, and most of them recognize that weeds are all about context. And so I remember my advisor at University of Kentucky often would have to testify in state court on behalf of lawn owners who said that their weeds were actually wildflowers, and he had to back them up because the definition of a plant is in the eye of a beholder. Mm. So I'm not sure that he fully was in favor of those kinds of lawns, but at the same time, he recognized the truth of it.
Yeah. Well, speaking of context, that's what makes a plant a weed.
Right.
Can you say anything more about that question? What makes a plant a weed? What makes a weed a weed?
Yes. Well, one thing I think is interesting is that we'll often see in wildflower guides that something is a plant is a weedy plant, or I have a book here called Weeds of the Northeast. And so the implication is that within that book, everything is a weed. But the reality is that those tend to be the plants that appear in places that somebody either hasn't fully planted so that it's got a healthy population of existing plants and so the weeds have space to come in, or that these tend to be the plants that have some other kind of problem. And actually, the fact that Amy Stewart's following me up here, she can talk about some of those weeds that have, or plants that have other problems and are therefore often considered weeds.
Yeah, we're scheduled to talk with her later this afternoon. I hope it comes off. We've been given word that we might have to reschedule, but she's the author of a book titled Wicked Plants, so hopefully we'll talk with her later today.
Right.
Well, speaking of interesting plants and one's idea of what a weed is, I did a Google search earlier in preparation for talking with you this afternoon about Scarlet Pimpernel, because this is not a plant that I'm familiar with.
Right.
So I did a Google search for Scarlet Pimpernel weed, and Google told me no results.
Really?
But among Google's suggestions, Scarlet Pimpernel flower.
Yes, interesting. Right. Well, it is a lovely little flower, and I'm surprised that no one has, in plant breeding efforts, tried to gigantize it and make it into something more than it currently is in size. Of course, it's a really little plant, and to see how beautiful its colors are, you nearly need a magnifying glass, but nonetheless, it's really lovely.
It is beautiful. There are photographs here on the web, and how did this little plant get called a weed?
Well, it's mainly because it isn't grass, and it can grow in lawns. And so because it's growing where no one put it, it's considered a weed sometimes. Now, this taste of having everything in the lawn be grass is a taste that was partly sold to us by seed and herbicide and lawn care companies. And those companies, in the process of trying to sell lawn seed and in the process of trying to sell fertilizer and herbicides, needed to define everything that wasn't the intended lawn grass as a weed. And at some point in there, Scarlet Pimpernel got thrown in the lot, though I don't actually think that even the herbicide companies were thinking about Scarlet Pimpernel when they invented their pesticides.
Yeah, well, I, speaking for my husband, he's really the gardener in our house, if we saw this growing in our lawn, he would dig it up and move it into the garden.
Right. It is so lovely, but I suspect also that in the wrong weather, he might not even see the flower because one of the names for it is poor man's weather glass, and it will close up if it's threatening rain. And so if it happened to be threatening rain when your husband saw it, all he would see is the little leaves and the flowers would be all closed up. So it's an interesting communicative little flower, but one that probably he wouldn't even notice as he was getting rid of it.
I don't know that we have this plant in our neck of the woods.
We'll probably do because I've seen it in Arkansas in a fairly dry pasture situation, and I've seen it in upstate New York in a fairly damp area, and certainly Illinois is squarely between the two. So, and I know it grows in all kinds of scrubby places.
Yeah. In your yard, in your lawn, you have a plant that is considered a weed, but it also is a handsome plant, I think. I have not seen it in this part of the country, although I have seen it in Maine and in northeastern Canada, hawkweed.
Yes. I just saw hawkweed in, I just saw hawkweed in Vancouver, Canada, and so I know that it is a widespread plant, and I know that it would grow certainly in Illinois and lots of other places, but I don't think that it necessarily likes dry too much, so I'm not sure you would see it in this part of Illinois you're in.
Very interesting. It looks like a tall, maybe I would say it looks like a cross between a tall dandelion and a daisy.
Yes, I think that's a very good description. And I have a really nice friend here who works with glass, and she was just able to make me a hawkweed out of blown glass in sort of a necklace pendant, and I'm feeling very lucky about that. She was asking what color to make it, and I said, just imagine your prettiest sunset colors and put it into a little dandelion-looking thing, and you'll have a hawkweed.
Yeah. Now, have you run into difficulties with your neighbors over a hawkweed in the lawn?
I haven't, actually. I have two neighbors, neither of whom sprays on either side of me, and so one of them I actually have some nice conversations with about the weeds, and he'll tell me about how when he was growing up in the Depression, he used to eat dandelion greens. The other neighbor and I don't talk nearly as much, but she's never raised any objection. I'm sure that there are neighborhoods where one might get more trouble about them. I actually get made fun of a lot more for using my push lawnmower, the real mower, than I do for any of my weeds.
I wonder if attitudes about weeds to some extent depend on the vibe of the neighborhood.
Yes, they do. And certainly our street has a lot of variability. There are a few neighbors who I can tell are really concerned with the perfect lawn, but lots of them aren't. So that's really nice that I have that kind of variability here. But for people who live in a neighborhood where it's really strict, I think there is a certain amount of pressure. And that is partly the audience of my book, is giving people some authority on which to say, these plants are good, and they don't need to be treated, and this isn't necessarily something that is actually going to do you any harm if I leave them in my lawn.
Mm. You say when you speak to the public about lawn care and speak about weeds in the course of your talk, you say you can almost hear the relief in the audience. The first time you felt that reaction, did it surprise you?
It sort of did, and I guess what I was surprised at most was not that people felt that they liked their weeds, but I was surprised that they felt guilty about it in the first place enough to have the relief.
Hmm.
So I felt that it was pretty easy. I, of course, am really biased, and I've liked my weeds in the lawn for quite a long time, but it was sort of a shock to realize that this was among the many things that people felt guilty for in their lives, and it really seemed like something that should be very far down the list of things to feel guilty for, if on that list at all.
Yeah. Is the idea of the lawn changing in America?
It definitely is, and I think the New York Times has tracked a lot of these sort of more renegade, wonderful gardeners, Fritz Haig, who advocates planting vegetables in the front lawn. There was an article on moss lawns in the New York Times as well. And there have also been articles in decorating magazines and garden magazines on having prairie lawns, especially in Illinois, and I think that's a lovely option. But sometimes there is reason for a mowed lawn or a short lawn, and in those cases, that's where I think this book really comes in. And also, I think appreciating the weeds in a lawn, in a regular lawn, is sort of the first step, that once you acknowledge that something besides grass might belong in the lawn, then you can start thinking about what you really want to have there. And maybe you do want to grow vegetables, and maybe in that case the weeds don't have as much of a place.
Mm.
But my first argument is that maybe something else belongs there besides grass.
Yeah. One can understand why farmers don't like weeds, and those of us with a patch of vegetables, herbs, and ornamental flowers work to keep the weeds down, if not out. But when and how did we come to the concept of the perfect lawn?
That's been sort of an evolution, but it occurred roughly around the time of World War II, after World War II, partly because before that time it wasn't possible. Before we had herbicides that could kill dandelions and clover but not kill grass, and that would include 2,4-D, which was one of the first major lawn herbicides and still one that you find on the shelves of any major home and garden store for homeowners to buy. That before that herbicide existed, it wasn't even possible to imagine that the lawn would be all grass. You could have a neatly trimmed lawn. You could have one that was absolutely sort of looked perfect from a distance, but the idea that it would have nothing in it besides grass was new to the herbicide era.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Nancy Gift. She's a weed scientist. She's assistant professor of environmental studies and acting director of the Rachel Carson Institute at Chatham University in Pittsburgh. And she's the author of A Weed by Any Other Name, The Virtues of a Messy Lawn, or Learning to Love the Plants We Don't Plant. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's take a call from a listener waiting for us on a cell phone, line one. Hi.
Hi, Celeste.
Hi.
Hi.
Miss Jack Paxton. There's a good book that is relevant to this, published by Jack Harlan, who was a professor of agronomy here. It's called Crops and Man.
Mm-hmm.
And his statement in there is that weeds shouldn't be confined to simply plants, that you can include animals, and he uses examples of the fruit fly and the brown sewer rat. And he goes on to say that even man, therefore, could be included as a weed, and that if we ever learn to control our own population, why, maybe we'll be the first example of a weed that's become domesticated.
Yes. I think that's really interesting.
That's a good chapter for people to look at, though, because he's a pretty good philosopher.
Mm-hmm. It's true that one of the characteristics that makes a weed, is that it tends to thrive in areas that have been disturbed by people.
Right, exactly. And
they get a foothold exactly because it may not be a developed area now, but it's something that was maybe disturbed in the process of development. And, of course,
yep.
What is more disturbed in the process of development than the making of a suburb?
Yep.
All of that soil is just ripe for weeds after the bulldozers have come through.
And as you've rightly stated, this sort of strange notion that we're given by companies that want to sell us herbicides and fertilizers and so forth, that a lawn has to be a monoculture, which is very unstable in its very nature, and that a more biodiverse system like the prairies we had here originally would be a much better system in terms of being able to flourish without a lot of inputs on the part of humans.
Yes, yes, definitely. One of an author that I particularly enjoyed from Illinois was Joel Greenberg, and he wrote about the prairies around Chicago that used to be there and in some cases still are. There was one story he shared in his book a few years back about an area that had been slated for development right around the time World War II broke out. And so they went in and they put in sidewalks was the first step, and then they were going to sell the lots and build the lots. But they didn't actually get to that stage before the war broke out. And so instead, the area ended up as being a prairie with sidewalks. And it's so interesting that just because they didn't do that bulldozing, that the sidewalks didn't really disturb things too much. And so
Right. It's
quite a nice little prairie just outside Chicago.
Actually gave people access to the prairie.
Right.
In a much easier way than normal. Mm-hmm.
Right.
We're hoping to do something like that on campus if we can get the university off the dime.
Right.
Hey, Jack.
Yeah.
Can you tell me, I've seen areas around town and on campus in particular where they are no longer mowing.
Right.
What's that about?
That's the first step towards trying to reduce the huge maintenance costs of maintaining lawns where people seldom use them. And we're hoping that the next step would be to actually put prairie in there so that you have a mixture of flowers and plants that are very biodiverse and therefore very stable.
Right.
And so the university could cut costs, but at the same time make the campus much more interesting by trying to reestablish some of the native prairie. And it's important to know that the native prairie was the very thing that created the most valuable resource in this area, namely our deep, rich prairie soils. And we've pretty much eliminated all of that prairie that once was important in creating the thing that we now consider very valuable, our very fertile deep soils.
Yeah.
So we're hoping that maybe it could be an educational exercise for students to learn what the native ecosystem was and why it was important.
Hmm. Interesting.
Well, thanks for the call this afternoon. Good to hear from you. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Nancy Gift is our guest. She's a weed scientist and the author of A Weed by Any Other Name, The Virtues of a Messy Lawn, or Learning to Love the Plants We Don't Plant. The no-mow areas, they have raised some eyebrows and a little bit of trouble in the minds of some. I know that there have been at least a couple of letters to the editor in the paper about those areas. So.
Right. I've run across that with my own university, that there are areas that we would like to reduce mowing on, and the first question is, what will the alumni and the trustees think? And it's a really tough question because, of course, the alumni and the trustees who are most in the position to give a lot of money are also the people who may be of the socioeconomic class to really have an image of what being in the upper class means. And that often means having a perfect grassy lawn. Mm. And so those are mixed up,
Unfortunately. Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Hi. I just heard your discussion about the prairies west of Chicago, and I want to encourage everybody to head out to Meadowbrook Park. The wildflowers are spectacular. We were just out there this morning for a walk, and it's just lovely and so accessible with the sidewalks.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a nice spot. I agree.
Thanks for the call. Other questions, comments are invited this afternoon for our guest, Nancy Gift, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I suspect, Nancy, you are a person who says never say never. So what are your thoughts about herbicides?
Well, I definitely think that there's a place for them. And one of the things I try very hard to do is to not judge somebody else's circumstances when I hear that they're using an herbicide. I've heard people who have bee allergic children tell me that they use an herbicide in their lawn because they want absolutely no clover and no risk of their child running across a bumblebee. Personally, I think that's a really tough call because even though the risks of some kinds of cancer are higher for kids who grow up on a sprayed lawn, cancer is something that happens far off in the distance, and a bee sting that could kill is something that happens right now. So I think that's a harder situation, and so I try hard not to judge those, but just to make sure that if somebody's thinking about spraying, that they're actually thinking about the situation and the plant that they're intending to spray. And then finally, to think about, and not least importantly, to think about what it is that they're applying. When I worked for Ag Extension, one of my jobs was to continually tell people to read the label on the product they use. And I don't know if any of your listeners have tried to read an herbicide label, but when you do, it's in four-point font, and it's incredibly difficult to read, even if you know where to look for it. It's not necessarily an easy proposition. And so I think, in general, it's easier to say, don't spray, or be really careful and thoughtful about what you're doing. But again, my approach that I really prefer to take is to say, look at this beautiful scarlet pimpernel, look at this beautiful violet, and then hope that the beauty of it makes the decision change rather than having it be about me Bible thumping or telling somebody what they should and shouldn't do.
Let's take another call, a listener in Whiteheath on line one. Hello.
Hi. I was really quite amused by the letter to the editor castigating the university for not mowing. And I think that part of it just needs to be a re-education to look at the beauty of the grass seed heads.
Right.
And the mixture of the meadows and the prairies and the fields, because it's a lot healthier for us.
Yes.
And I was wondering where the cut lawn industry began, possibly, and then how did the chemical industry decide that it should be applied to fields and lawns, and where did that all begin?
You know, there's a really good book on that, and the author's first name is Virginia, and it's called something, History of the American Lawn. And she does a really good job going into that. And so I deliberately didn't span that research because it's been really well covered a couple of times. I'll give you my short impression version of it, and then you can go look up dates and particulars. The basic idea is that there are these wonderful European estates, Versailles, the palace kinds of estates, and that those estates had all-grass lawns, or that they had even short-grass lawns. And they probably had a lot of other things in them, of course, because they didn't have herbicides then. And then when we started introducing the idea of a suburb, that the suburb sort of became the symbol of using your land as showing that you had property rather than using your land to raise your own food. And so because the land had symbolic value rather than economic value, that the land was kept in the same way as those estates. One of the side things about having your land have show value instead of economic value is that you no longer think about how much it costs to spray that last dandelion, because that dandelion is a symbol of your economic status. Whereas if you were actually thinking about what your dollars payback is for that dandelion, if you spray the dandelion, like a corn farmer would think about, I'm not going to spray because it's not worth it to me. A lawn owner is never going to have that economic just. It's never going to tip that way because this is sort of beyond money. It's a symbol.
Does the listener want to follow up?
No, thank you very much.
Well, you're very welcome for the call this afternoon. Clover seed used to be in grass seed mixes, but no longer.
Right, right. I love clover. And I have heard people point out that it's a non-native, and that is certainly true, but it is a non-native that is at one time was so ubiquitously seeded in all of our lawns that it's really not fair to think that if we stopped adding clover or stopped appreciating clover that it would go away or that we could ever eradicate it completely. It contributes nitrogen to our lawns. Right now we're having a fairly dry short spell here in Pennsylvania, and as I look out at my lawn, the greenest stuff out there is the clover. The grass is getting a little crispy, but the clover is really hanging on. In winter, it's one of the things that looks green and lush when everything else is in its winter brown state. So I think of clover as really indispensable to a beautiful lawn.
Mm. And the author you were trying to think of, Virginia Scott Jenkins.
Thank you very much. Yes, exactly.
The Lawn, A History of an American Obsession.
Thank you. Yeah. Yes. It's a good book on that historical perspective for anyone who'd like to delve into that.
Okay, so back to the idea of a weed is a plant in the wrong place.
Yes.
What do you do battle with in your backyard?
Well, one is certainly the violets in my flower bed, and I still, because right now they're not blooming, and so it's just this swath of my flower bed that I can't seem to get to yield anything else. One of the plants I struggle with most is poison ivy, because I keep struggling with it for the sake of my kids. And poison ivy is a plant that I am not particularly sensitive to, but I know that the more exposure you have to it, the more sensitive you get. And I'd like these kids to be able to play outside. One thing that I think is interesting about poison ivy is people think of it as being in the woods. And, of course, it is in the woods, but it tends to really be in the edges. It's an edge plant, so it likes to be on the edge between lawns and woods. And so if all we have around our subdivisions are little thin banks of woods, maybe 20 feet, 30 feet deep, then poison ivy will thrive in those spaces, whereas if we had a little bit more woodland or actually a denser prairie, the poison ivy would be outcompeted. It doesn't like shade all that well. It tolerates it, but it's not its favorite spot.
Yeah. You have an interesting situation in your backyard because there's an area that can be pretty weedy or is weedy, but it serves as a boundary between your yard and a parking lot.
Right. And it's a particularly nice boundary because it's a pool parking lot, and so the only time of year when we really need it as a boundary is in summer. And as it turns out, that's exactly the time of the year when the weeds are in full leaf and they can give us some sound and sight protection from that parking lot.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest is Nancy Gift. She's a weed scientist. She's the author of A Weed by Any Other Name, The Virtues of a Messy Lawn, or Learning to Love the Plants We Don't Plant. And you'll find her blogging at weedsandkids.blogspot.com. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. We have a good chunk of time left here on the program this afternoon, so if you'd like to join our discussion this afternoon with questions, comments, give us a call, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, and that's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Wilderness and kids and managed wilderness. Yards, you say, are not really wild, but there is room for wildness in them depending on how we construct them. How is the yard and this managed wildness good for kids?
Well, for one, because we have so little space where kids can run these days. I read in Richard Louv's book about kids' home range being reduced. And of course, when my parents were little, there was a wide range of space that they could run around. When I say range, it means basically that the kid could say, "Mom, I'm going out." And they were gone, and that range could be in miles. 1 to 5 miles is sort of typical for when I talk to older people. And kids these days have typically a home range which is less than a quarter mile. Given that that home range is so small, I think it puts an extra emphasis on the yard and what you can discover there. If kids used to run loose around the prairie or around the edges of their farm, or if they used to run loose in woodlands, then those were spaces where they had a chance to learn about all kinds of organisms, frogs, toads, squirrels, maybe even something slightly more threatening. We had a fox in our neighborhood. Fortunately, the kids have never run across it, but these are the kinds of wildness that kids don't really see much of. And so at the very least, we should be thinking about what kinds of wilderness our kids are getting access to when they're home in the lawn, which at least typically is the one place where parents still feel safe letting their kids play if they do indeed have access to a lawn.
What was it like when your kids discovered dandelions, when they were old enough to pick a dandelion?
Well, I guess I'm not sure that they really got a fair chance to discover dandelions without my help, because I've been enough of a fan of them. But I have some lovely pictures from when my first daughter was just over a year, basically as soon as she could walk. In fact, the first time she stood up, I put her in the yard, and I had to walk across the yard to get something else. And I turned around to come back toward her, and she was standing there. And it was surrounded by dandelions, and it was just a lovely time of year. And so she would pick them, the kids rub them on their cheeks and pretend that they're blush. It's probably the safest blush that you would ever want a kid to play makeup with. And so discovering dandelions first, of course, is the flower, and then those seed heads are just irresistible to blow on, much to some neighbors' annoyance. One thing that I do think is interesting to point out, though, about dandelions is that as much as they annoy people, and yes, they do flower at all times of year, but there's really one big flush of dandelions and dandelion seed. That dandelions can flower all year round, but there's sort of a coordinated flush at some point early in spring. This year, to me, it was April. I've seen it happen in June. But basically, that one flush is really the only time after that you're going to get a lot of the seed heads. And then they're not totally gone for the rest of the year, but they're really not as bad after that, whereas people think of it as a year-round problem.
Yeah. A listener called a good while ago now, but I remember the story to this day. In order to keep the next crop of dandelions down a little bit and to have fun with the kids, he said, "I'll give you a penny for every yellow dandelion you pick for me." And that kept them from going to seed.
Right.
And I guess he could have made dandelion wine as a result of that exercise as well. Tell us about that.
Well, dandelion wine requires gathering a gallon of blooms on a dry day. And it is surprising how many days of the year that you could not make dandelion wine, even if you decided that you were really ready and you had all of the other equipment necessary, because there just aren't enough dandelions all at once to do that. But during that big spring flush of dandelions, that would be exactly the time for that parent to send the kids out with a penny apiece. And I'm not sure what the wine would go for, but certainly it would be an awfully nice compensation. You win both ways. You get to send the kids out and keep them busy for a while, and then later on you get to enjoy the fruits in winter. So,
yeah. How does backyard wildlife make use of the plants we call weeds?
Well, many of them treat the weeds as food, and they're are some books about particular animals and what they eat and American wildlife and what they eat. But basically, I'll address particularly clover in this respect, that wild grazers such as bunnies or deer, of course, really like clover. Now, I've had people ask me if maybe they shouldn't keep the clover out because that might discourage the deer, but I've really never seen any evidence that deer will avoid your garden plants simply because you keep the clover out. And it's, I think, entirely possible that a full deer is a deer that's not going after your flower bed. But, you know, I think any of that sort of trying to behavior manage the animals is difficult. And since kids have little enough wildlife to see anyway, I think if the weeds help feed the wildlife a little bit, then so much the better. And I'm sure some of your listeners at least are hunters, and maybe that clover will help their deer be a little bit fatter come hunting season.
Mm. As I was reading your book, I came up with this question. What would happen if all the plants we consider weeds were to disappear overnight?
Yeah. I think we'd have a lot of air space.
And we'd have some big problems. We'd have erosion. We would have flooding, perhaps, because of wild runoff after a rain.
Certainly lower water quality, because weeds are holding from the water, at least they're filtering the water and sending it back up into the air. I mean, all of the benefits we think of as plants, we always tell children that plants are good, and we're thinking of trees, and we're thinking of tree plantings or vegetable gardens or that kind of thing. But there are huge amounts of space which are not covered by anything but weeds, or at least ignored plants, and many of those will be weeds. And it's filtering air for us, it's filtering water. Almost all municipal areas have water quality issues. I think the weeds are really doing us a big service on a broad scale.
Mm. When my husband and I, when we bought our home, we had to deal with some very problematic plants. One of them, Tree of Heaven.
Yes.
And it was planted to kind of be a placeholder and to provide some shade quickly. But what a pest.
Yes. And it certainly does that. In this week's New Yorker, there's an article about a Tree Museum in Brooklyn, and one of the trees that's labeled in this museum is an ailanthus. And the neighbor who lives closest to that, of course, and ailanthus, or tree of heaven, is the tree that was written about in A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. It has its moment, and that really is in cities where, because it's very pollution tolerant, and maybe other trees won't deal with the compacted soil there or won't deal with the pollution. Of course, ailanthus does not restrict itself voluntarily to those areas, and if it did, maybe we wouldn't mind it so much, because if you're in Champaign-Urbana, you're certainly not in an overly polluted area, and I'm sure you'd rather have a nice maple or oak in that place instead.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's ferocious.
Yes, it is. And unfortunately, with its really brittle wood, it's not as if you can start making things out of it, or it's not a very useful wood. Though I have heard rumors of medicinal uses and that kind of thing. I guess Amy Stewart has that mentioned in her book as well. I'm always interested to hear what use people put weeds to when they had fewer other options. So again, though, I think it's all about that plant and that place. In your yard where you know that you can grow other trees, that ailanthus is a weed.
Yeah. Also, for a time, we did battle with Virginia creeper, which is a very useful plant in the right place.
It is. And that one's a native, so I feel particularly fondly toward it. It's so beautiful in fall when it turns red just a little before everything else does. I've always liked to have a Virginia creeper and goldenrod in a bouquet together because they tend to be beautiful at about the same time. Mm. But, of course, it can be very damaging to trees. I don't think that's incredibly hard to manage in a tree situation because, of course, all you have to do is cut it at the base. But it obviously could spread over other spaces as well. I like Virginia creeper, but I do understand it can be an issue.
Yeah. My in-laws have it in a very nice place. It's wonderful where they have it growing. It's on a hilly spot underneath the stairs to the back porch.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great in that place.
Right.
And they just manage it by clipping it.
Right, because that would be a spot that would be possibly hazardous to mow or certainly very difficult to mow. And that's one of the, of course, kudzu was introduced for similar purposes and went terribly badly. But I have to say, I wonder what would have happened if we hadn't just sort of encouraged Virginia creeper in the places where they were trying to get kudzu to grow instead of introducing a whole new plant for that purpose.
Yeah. Speaking of an introduced plant, the multiflora rose,
mm-hmm.
It can be good and it can be bad.
Right.
What's its story?
Well, my read on multiflora rose was that it was introduced shortly after the time when the French grape industry was saved by introduction of Concord grape rootstock. And so given that roses had, and I'm not sure of the particular disease without looking it up again, but that roses, domestic roses, which of course are very highly prized, had some problem, and they thought that maybe if they introduced multiflora rose as a wild plant that it could help improve the healthfulness and the vigorousness of the stock of the domestic roses. And unfortunately, as with many introduced weed stories, it didn't work out that way, and instead what we have is a whole lot of wild multiflora rose, and our domestic roses have just as many problems as they did before. But there are a lot of stories of these weeds that were introduced with some noble purpose in mind, and they went awry. And on one hand, it seems like, well, that doesn't really make the plant any less of a villain. It still did all the evil things that it did. But on the other hand, I think it should, as the caller earlier who mentioned that sort of weeds and humans have a certain affinity, we seem to bring them in and then be sorry that we brought them in. And I think it just encourages, we should move toward caution in all of our plant introductions. Even cross-country, I mean, one state to another, a plant that can be invasive in one state is sometimes not at all invasive in a slightly different climate.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Nancy Gift is our guest today. She's an assistant professor of environmental studies and acting director of the Rachel Carson Institute at Chatham University in Pittsburgh. She's the author of A Weed by Any Other Name, The Virtues of a Messy Lawn, or Learning to Love the Plants We Don't Plant. You'll find her online at weedsandkids.blogspot.com. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, this is the Afternoon Magazine, and we've got about 5-6 minutes left in this portion of the program. We could take a couple of calls if you'd like to join us with a question or a comment. 333-9455, toll free 800 1-800-222-9455. Well, what are your thoughts about wild garlic and garlic mustard?
Well, besides them being tasty, both of them can be immensely frustrating. So I confess that even when I go hiking in a place that I know I may not be going back and I don't really have much hope of maintaining it, I will still pull a few garlic mustard and then often realize that the task is impossible. Mm. But at the same time, we have disturbed those areas, and so I guess I can't really blame the plant too much. I know there was a group here, Steel City Biofuels, that went and harvested garlic mustard seed one spring and pressed it into fuel, into oil to make biodiesel. They apparently got a better run from it than they expected. So I guess they have their uses. Mm. The wild garlic especially, I think, is an interesting one, and I would still love to hear corroboration of the story I once heard that they actually keep it in the wheat fields in France because it enhances the flavor of the bread made from that wheat.
Huh.
But I haven't been able to get a written documentation of that.
Oh, interesting. Let's take a call or two here. Next, we go to a listener in Mahomet on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I missed most of the show, but I'm really enjoying it. We have sometimes problems with Canadian thistle. We live in the country.
Yeah.
And but my husband always says, well, you have to look at the bright side. The birds love it.
They do. They really like thistle seed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a question. Our flower bed was taken over by mint.
Mm-hmm.
And so I get a lot of grape mint pesto, but it's way more than I can handle.
Right.
Any suggestions?
Yeah. Right. I guess you're asking sort of what would one possibly do about that?
Well, yeah, I'd like to either completely get it out of that flower bed or restrict it to a certain part of the flower bed.
Right, right. In terms of restricting it, what I've seen some people do, and one problem with mint is that it can spread over the surface of the ground, and so that's hard. But with some plants, you can plant them in the garden in a pot, and especially if you leave the sides of the pot up a couple of inches, then the plant can be better restricted to that location. And sometimes people, if they're doing a demonstration garden of invasive weeds, that's how they'll do it. They'll keep the plant in its pot. If you're trying to get rid of it, I think that's really a good case for some kind of mulch or maybe even landscape fabric for a year or two. And that
okay.
would probably kill it off, and you could cut holes for the plants that you're desiring, and it would at least reduce the area that you have to pull the mint in.
Well, those are both great ideas. I really
good.
Appreciate it.
Good.
Thank
Absolutely.
You.
Next, we talk with a listener in Mattoon, line two. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing this afternoon?
Very glad to talk to you.
I've got a wild grapevine growing, and I've heard conflicting rumors on both sides. And earlier in the year, it had like little clusters of little white flowers growing on it.
Yes.
And I thought maybe that'll produce grapes, but so far it's just producing a lot of vines.
Well, they do indeed produce grapes, at least in the right circumstances. And I have to say my husband's a big fan of, he calls them fox grapes, which is basically wild grapes. And they're little and a little bit sour and kind of seedy, but that's never seemed to stop him too much. It's also a native, so it's a plant that has some food value. One of the reasons you may not see too many grapes is that they're so very edible for wildlife, and so birds would be very fond of them. But it's true that it does produce grapes, and if you are ever lucky enough to get them, then you could certainly make use of that. It's not the same as Concord grape, unfortunately, so not quite as sweet, but can be tasty. I've had good ones.
All right, that's what I wanted to know.
Good.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. Next, we go to a listener in Champaign on line three. Hi.
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 Could you talk about mulberry trees? I know there are three kinds in Illinois, and my neighbor's very upset. These have grown up on the edge of my property, and they're kind of covering a garage on the other side. And
right.
She called them invasive, and she got pretty upset about it. And I kind of like them.
Yeah, actually, we also have a mulberry tree, which fortunately we share with a neighbor who tends to like it as well. I think the only... You know, the two complaints are that the berries stain the sidewalk. They're actually really tasty berries in a whole variety of ripeness phases. They don't have very nice architecture, so the limbs tend to kind of break off, and it's not sort of a smooth, graceful tree like an elm. But I wouldn't say there's any real strong argument, objective argument against mulberry. Obviously, your neighbor has a particular prejudice against it, but
Well, some men were cutting the tree for the power lines. They cut a bunch in my backyard. I told them not to, but they did anyway. It seems to be a prejudice everywhere, or they're called illegal or something.
Interesting. I hadn't heard about them being illegal, but of course my own township has some kind of odd weed laws as well. So I believe it, but I don't think it's a really clear. There's no really clear reason for that prejudice. They're not particularly invasive in wild areas. It's true that they'll come into your yard, but not too bad out in the wild.
Well, they're kind of covering up a white garage and sort of stopping the glare and adding a little shade.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it's sort of free landscaping myself.
Right, right. I think there will always be those kinds of philosophical differences among neighbors. And so.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. And there we will wrap it up for this July 16th, 2009. With our guest Nancy Gift, and I am told that Amy Stewart is on for later this afternoon. She'll join us this afternoon to talk about plants that are unlovable. She's the author of the book Wicked Plants, and she'll join us this afternoon following the closing market report at 2:45. Nancy Gift, thanks so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure being on.
Nancy Gift is Assistant Professor of Environmental Studies and Acting Director of the Rachel Carson Institute at Chatham University in Pittsburgh. She's the author of A Weed by Any Other Name, The Virtues of a Messy Lawn, or Learning to Love the Plants We Don't Plant. The book is published by the Beacon Press, and you'll find her online at weedsandkids.blogspot.com.